Chapter 12. Tom, on their part, thought their Aunt Pullet tolerable, chiefly because she was not their Aunt Glegg. Tom always declined to go more than once during his holidays to see either of them. Both his uncles tipped him at once, of course, but at his Aunt Pullet's there were a great many toads to pelt in the cellar area, so that he preferred the visit to her. Maggie shuddered at the toads, and dreamed of them horribly, but she liked her Uncle Pullet's musical snuffbox. Still, it was agreed by the sisters, in Mrs. Tulliver's absence, that the Tulliver blood did not mix well with the Dodson blood, that, in fact, poor Bessie's children were Tullivers, and that Tom, notwithstanding he had the Dodson complexion, was likely to be as contrary as his father. As for Maggie, she was the picture of her Aunt Moss, Mr. Tulliver's sister, a large-boned woman, who had married as poorly as could be, had no china, and had a husband who had much ado to pay his rent. But when Mrs. Pullet was alone with Mrs. Tulliver upstairs, the remarks were naturally to the disadvantage of Mrs. Glegg, and they agreed, in confidence, that there was no knowing what sort of fright Sister Jane would come out next. But their tete-a-tete was curtailed by the appearance of Mrs. Dean with little Lucy, and Mrs. Tulliver had to look on with a silent pang while Lucy's blonde curls were adjusted. It was quite unaccountable that Mrs. Dean, the thinnest and sallowest of all the Miss Dodsons, should have had this child, who might have been taken for Mrs. Tulliver's any day. And Maggie always looked twice as dark as usual when she was by the side of Lucy. She did today, when she and Tom came in from the garden with their father and their Uncle Glegg. Maggie had thrown her bonnet off very carelessly, and coming in with her hair rough as well as out of curl, rushed at once to Lucy, who was standing by her mother's knee. Certainly the contrast between the cousins was conspicuous, and to superficial eyes was very much to the disadvantage of Maggie, though a connoisseur might have seen points in her which had a higher promise for maturity than Lucy's natty completeness. It was like the contrast between a rough, dark, overgrown puppy and a white kitten. Lucy put up the neatest little rosebud mouth to be kissed. Everything about her was neat, her little round neck, with the row of coral beads, her little straight nose, not at all snubby, her little clear eyebrows, rather darker than her curls, to match hazel eyes, which looked up with shy pleasure at Maggie, taller by the head, though scarcely a year older. Maggie always looked at Lucy with delight. She was fond of fancying a world where the people never got any larger than children of their own age, and she made the queen of it just like Lucy, with a little crown on her head, and a little scepter in her hand. Only the queen was Maggie herself in Lucy's form. "Oh, Lucy," she burst out, after kissing her, "you'll stay with Tom and me, won't you? Oh, kiss her, Tom." Tom, too, had come up to Lucy, but he was not going to kiss her, no. He came up to her with Maggie, because it seemed easier, on the whole, than saying, "How do you do?" to all those aunts and uncles. He stood looking at nothing in particular, with the blushing, awkward air and semi-smile which are common to shy boys when in company, very much as if they had come into the world by mistake, and found it in a degree of undress that was quite embarrassing. "Heyday," said Aunt Glegg, with loud emphasis. "Do little boys and gels come into a room without taking notice of their uncles and aunts? That wasn't the way when I was a little gel." "Go and speak to your aunts and uncles, my dears," said Mrs. Tulliver, looking anxious and melancholy. She wanted to whisper to Maggie a command to go and have her hair brushed. "Well, and how do you do? And I hope you're good children, are you?" said Aunt Glegg, in the same loud emphatic way, as she took their hands, hurting them with her large rings, and kissing their cheeks much against their desire. "El, look up. Tom, look up. Boys as go to boarding school should hold their heads up. Look at me now." Tom declined that pleasure apparently, for he tried to draw his hand away. "Put your hair behind your ears, Maggie, and keep your frock on your shoulder." And Glegg always spoke to them in this loud emphatic way, as if she considered them deaf, or perhaps rather idiotic, It was a means, she thought, of making them feel that they were accountable creatures, and might be a salutary check on naughty tendencies. Bessie's children were so spoiled they'd need have somebody to make them feel their duty. "Well, my dears," said Aunt Pullet, in a compassionate voice, "you grow wonderful fast. I doubt they'll outgrow their strength," she added, looking over their heads, with a melancholy expression, at their mother. I think the gel has too much hair. I'd have it thinned and cut shorter, sister, if I was you. It isn't good for her health. It's that as makes her skin so brown, I shouldn't wonder. Don't you think so, Sister Dean?" "I can't say, I'm sure, sister," said Mrs. Dean, shutting her lips close again, and looking at Maggie with a critical eye. "No, no," said Mr. Tulliver, "the child's healthy enough. There's nothing ails her. There's red wheat as well as white, for that matter, and some like the dark grain best. But it 'ud be as well if Bessie 'ud have the child's hair cut, so as it 'ud lie smooth." A dreadful resolve was gathering in Maggie's breast, but it was arrested by the desire to know from her Aunt Dean whether she would leave Lucy behind. Aunt Dean would hardly ever let Lucy come to see them. After various reasons for refusal, Mrs. Dean appealed to Lucy herself. "You wouldn't like to stay behind without Mother, should you, Lucy?" "Yes, please, Mother," said Lucy, timidly, blushing very pink all over her little neck. "Well done, Lucy. Let her stay, Mrs. Dean, let her stay," said Mr. Dean, a large but alert-looking man, with a type of physique to be seen in all ranks of English society: bald crown, red whiskers, full forehead, and general solidity without heaviness. "You may see noblemen like Mr. Dean, and you may see grocers or day laborers like him, but the keenness of his brown eyes was less common than his contour. He held a silver snuff box very tightly in his hand, and now and then exchanged a pinch with Mr. Tulliver, whose box was only silver-mounted, so that it was naturally a joke between them that Mr. Tulliver wanted to exchange snuff boxes also. Mr. Dean's box had been given him by the superior partners in the firm to which he belonged, at the same time that they gave him a share in the business, in acknowledgement of his valuable services as manager. No man was thought more highly of in St. Ogg's than Mr. Dean, and some persons were even of opinion that Miss Susan Dodson, who was once held to have made the worst match of all the Dodson sisters, might one day ride in a better carriage, and live in a better house, even than her sister Pullet. There was no knowing where a man would stop who had got his foot into a great mill-owning, ship-owning business like that of Guest and Company, with a banking concern attached. And Mrs. Dean, as her intimate female friends observed, was proud and daring enough. She wouldn't let her husband stand still in the world for want of spurring. "Maggie," said Mrs. Tulliver, beckoning Maggie to her, and whispering in her ear, as soon as this point of Lucy's staying was settled, "go and get your hair brushed, do, for shame. I told you not to come in without going to Martha first, you know I did." "Tom, come out with me," whispered Maggie, pulling his sleeve as she passed him, and Tom followed willingly enough. "Come upstairs with me, Tom," she whispered, when they were outside the door. "Tea, there's something I want to do before dinner." "There's no time to play at anything before dinner," said Tom, whose imagination was impatient of any intermediate prospect. "Oh yes, there is time for this. Do come, Tom." Tom followed Maggie upstairs into her mother's room, and saw her go at once to a drawer, from which she took out a large pair of scissors. "What are they for, Maggie?" said Tom, feeling his curiosity awakened. Maggie answered by seizing her front locks, and cutting them straight across the middle of her forehead. "Oh, my buttons! Maggie, you'll catch it!" exclaimed Tom. "You'd better not cut any more off." Snip! Went the great scissors again, while Tom was speaking, and he couldn't help feeling it was rather good fun. Maggie would look so queer. "Here, Tom, cut it behind for me," said Maggie, excited by her own daring, and anxious to finish the deed. You'll catch it, you know, said Tom, nodding his head in an admonitory manner, and hesitating a little as he took the scissors. Never mind, make haste, said Maggie, giving a little stamp with her foot. Her cheeks were quite flushed. The black locks were so thick, nothing could be more tempting to a lad who had already tasted the forbidden pleasure of cutting the pony's mane. I speak to those who know the satisfaction of making a pair of scissors meet through a duly resisting mass of hair. One delicious grinding snip, and then another, and the hinder locks fell heavily on the floor, and Maggie stood cropped in a jagged, uneven manner, but with a sense of clearness and freedom, as if he had emerged from a wood into the open plain. Oh, Maggie, said Tom, jumping round her, and slapping his knees as he laughed. Oh, my buttons! What a queer thing you look! Look at yourself in the glass. You look like the idiot we throw out nutshells to at school. Maggie felt an unexpected pang. As he had thought beforehand chiefly at her own deliverance from her teasing hair and teasing remarks about it, and something also of the triumph she should have over her mother and her aunts by this very decided course of action. She didn't want her hair to look pretty, that was out of the question. She only wanted people to think her a clever little girl, and not to find fault with her. But now, when Tom began to laugh at her, and say she was like an idiot, the affair had quite a new aspect. She looked in the glass, and still Tom laughed, and clapped his hands, and Maggie's cheeks began to pale, and her lips to tremble a little. Oh, Maggie, you'll have to go down to dinner directly, said Tom. Oh, my. Don't laugh at me, Tom, said Maggie, in a passionate tone, with an outburst of angry tears, stamping, and giving him a push. Now then, spitfire, said Tom. What did you cut it off for, then? I shall go down. I can smell the dinner going in. He hurried downstairs, and left poor Maggie to that bitter sense of the irrevocable which was almost an everyday experience of her small soul. She could see clearly enough, now the thing was done, that it was very foolish, and that she should have to hear and think more about her hair than ever, for Maggie rushed to her deeds with passionate impulse, and then saw, not only their consequences, but what would have happened, if they had not been done, with all the detail and exaggerated circumstance of an active imagination. Tom never did the same sort of foolish things as Maggie, having a wonderful instinctive discernment of what would turn to his advantage or disadvantage. And so it happened, that though he was much more willful and inflexible than Maggie, his mother hardly ever called him naughty. But if Tom did make a mistake of that sort, he espoused it, and stood by it. He didn't mind. If he broke the lash of his father's gig whip by lashing the gate, he couldn't help it, the whip shouldn't have got caught in the hinge. If Tom Tulliver whipped a gate, he was convinced, not that the whipping of gates by all boys was a justifiable act, but that he, Tom Tulliver, was justifiable in whipping that particular gate, and he wasn't going to be sorry. But Maggie, as she stood crying before the glass, felt it impossible that she should go down to dinner and endure the severe eyes and severe words of her aunts, while Tom and Lucy and Martha, who waited at table, and perhaps her father and her uncles, would laugh at her. For if Tom had laughed at her, of course everyone else would. And if he had only let her hair alone, she could have sat with Tom and Lucy and had the apricot pudding and the custard. What could she do but sob? She sat as helpless and despairing among her black locks as a jack's among the slaughtered sheep. Very trivial, perhaps, this anguish seems to weather-worn mortals who have to think of Christmas bills, dead loves, and broken friendships. But it was not less bitter to Maggie, perhaps it was even more bitter than what we are fond of calling antithetically the real troubles of mature life. Ah, my child, you will have real troubles to fret about by and by, is the consolation we have almost all of us had administered to us in our childhood, and have repeated to other children, since we have been grown up. We have all of us sobbed so piteously, standing with tiny bare legs above our little socks, when we lost sight of our mother or nurse in some strange place. But we can no longer recall the poignancy of that moment and weep over it, as we do over the remembered sufferings of 5 or 10 years ago. Every one of those keen moments has left its trace, and lives in us still, but such traces have blent themselves irrecoverably with the firmer texture of our youth and manhood. And so it comes, that we can look on at the troubles of our children with a smiling disbelief in the reality of their pain. Is there anyone who can recover the experience of his childhood, not merely with a memory of what he did, and what happened to him, of what he liked and disliked, when he was in frock and trousers, but with an intimate penetration, a revived consciousness of what he felt then, when it was so long from one midsummer to another, what he felt when his schoolfellows shut him out of their game, because he would pitch the ball wrong out of mere willfulness, or on a rainy day in the holidays, when he didn't know how to amuse himself, and fell from idleness into mischief, from mischief into defiance, and from defiance into sulkiness, or when his mother absolutely refused to let him have a tailed coat that Alf, although every other boy of his age, had gone into tails already. Surely if we could recall that early bitterness, and the dim guesses, the strangely perspectiveless conception of life, that gave the bitterness its intensity, we should not poo-poo the griefs of our children. Miss Maggie, you're to come down this minute, said Kezia, entering the room hurriedly. Ellox, what have you been a-doing? I never see such a fright. Don't, Kezia, said Maggie, angrily. Gee, go away. But I tell you you're to come down, miss, this minute. Your mother says so, said Kezia, going up to Maggie and taking her by the hand, to raise her from the floor. Get away, Kezia. I don't want any dinner, said Maggie, resisting Kezia's arm. I shan't come. Oh, well, I can't stay. I've got to wait at dinner, said Kezia, going out again. Maggie, you little silly, said Tom, peeping into the room 10 minutes after, why don't you come and have your dinner? There's lots o' goodies, and mother says you're to come. What are you crying for, you little spoony? Oh, it was dreadful. Tom was so hard and unconcerned. If he had been crying on the floor, Maggie would have cried too. And there was the dinner, so nice. And she was so hungry. It was very bitter. But Tom was not altogether hard. He was not inclined to cry, and did not feel that Maggie's grief spoiled his prospect of the sweets. But he went, and put his head near her, and said in a lower, comforting tone, won't you come, then, Maxie? Shall I bring you a bit o' pudding when I've had mine, and a custard and things? Yes, said Maggie, beginning to feel life a little more tolerable. Very well, said Tom, going away. But he turned again at the door and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.